Okay, well, let's go to the Lord real quick. Father, thank you for your word, Lord. And there's times when there are things in your word, Lord, which seem complex, Lord, and difficult to understand, but we know that by your Spirit, Lord, that you give us light and that you lead us in all truth. And so we ask for that tonight. I ask that you would set me aside in a sense, Lord, and just speak speak those things that you would have me speak, Lord, to touch hearts, and that you would help us to recognize and hear the things that you want us to hear tonight as we continue on through this incredible book, Lord, of Daniel in chapter 4. And I just ask all these things in your mighty name, Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. Well, last time we were together, chapter 3, we saw the Lord deliver Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whose real names are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the reason I say their real names is because there's such a contrast to me in the names that Nebuchadnezzar assigned to them or gave them, and their real Hebrew names. Their Hebrew names are beautiful, and they have a beautiful meaning, as we discussed, I think, back in chapter 1, versus Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are names of idols or demonic figures within the Babylonian culture. So I just like to, every now and then, reassert that it's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And the Lord delivered them from certain death in the fiery furnace and from the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar. And if you recall, back in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar told them if they refused to worship the idol that he had erected, that they would be cast into the fiery furnace. And he posed the question to them in chapter 3, verse 15, "And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Almost sounds like an arrogant challenge in a sense. Who is that God who will deliver you out of my hands? And of course, his question was answered first by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And that was in chapter 3, verses 16 through 18, when they answered Nebuchadnezzar and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." And of course, as we know, following their answer, which further enraged Nebuchadnezzar and resulted in them being cast into the fiery furnace, you remember it was heated 7 times hotter at Nebuchadnezzar's command, and it was so hot, the Bible tells us, that it killed the soldiers that were tasked with throwing the Hebrew men into the fire. And it was then, at that very moment, that Nebuchadnezzar got his most definitive answer to his question, "And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" Well, suddenly, that God who would do that was right before him. 3 were thrown into the furnace, and suddenly Nebuchadnezzar saw a 4th. The 4th being the God who would and did deliver the Hebrew men from the fire. As Jesus walked with them in the flames, and as Nebuchadnezzar, in utter astonishment, the Bible tells us, went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace. I'm assuming he didn't get too close, because the last guys who did that were killed. And the Bible tells us that he spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair on their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. And right after that, again back in chapter 3, immediately after this, we read Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation and a decree. And it says that Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Now, Nebuchadnezzar made a similar statement, although it wasn't quite as robust as this last decree that he issued, but he made a similar statement back in chapter 2, and that was after all of his wise men could not interpret the dream, couldn't tell him what the dream was to begin with, and then they couldn't interpret it. And of course, the Lord allowed Daniel to go before the king and to interpret it, tell him what the dream was, give him the interpretation, and that averted all the wise men from being slain, along with Daniel and his friends. But at that time in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar said this. He said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." So twice now, Nebuchadnezzar has seen God's power, and he's witnessed God's sovereignty over all things, including Nebuchadnezzar himself. But he has not reached the point that he submits himself to God. He acknowledges God on one hand, but Nebuchadnezzar is a prideful man. And remember, he's an idolater. The Babylonian culture is a culture of false religion and idol worship, and its king is no less an idol worshiper. So he acknowledges God, but pride is still a huge obstacle for him. For as we know, acknowledging God is still far short of submitting to him. Nebuchadnezzar was suffering from the same old malady that keeps many from saving grace, from the saving grace of God, and is even an obstacle to us as believers, in our Christian walk and our relationship with others. Pride, it gets in the way. And pride is a sin, and it's not something new. I mean, it's what brought Satan to his fall, was pride. The Apostle John wrote in 1 John chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, he says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever." So as we enter into chapter 4, we'll see yet another dream, another interpretation, and another proclamation. And better said, that what we're going to see from King Nebuchadnezzar is a testimony. Did I say chapter 3?
4.
Yeah. As we enter into chapter 4. And it's a reminder, when you see this chapter, as you read through it, it's a reminder that if you're praying for someone to get saved, and other people say, "Well, that person, that guy, that woman, they'll never get saved," we'll point those people to Daniel chapter 4, to the idol-worshipping pagan king who ruled the world's greatest empire, and remember, with God, all things are possible. Verse 1, chapter 4. "Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you." Notice the salutation. It's not Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Rather, it says simply, king. And it's written to or addressed to the world, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. I think that gives us kind of an idea of the scope and size of this empire. I mean, it was the world's greatest empire. You know, we like to, and I hear it all the time, if you listen to the radio or you hear people talk, especially the political pundits, they'll say, "Well, the United States," they'll say, "the greatest nation that ever existed." But in reality, if you think of the United States as a concept of its own empire, it's not the greatest nation that ever existed. The greatest one was Babylon. It was King Nebuchadnezzar. He ruled the world at the time. There were other people in the world, but there was none who could challenge him. He was that mighty. God made him that mighty. Verses 2 and 3. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Well, this is likely a proclamation that was issued sometime, probably on the heels of Daniel's return to the province. Remember, in the last chapter, there was no Daniel. He was away, basically, on the king's business. They say, commentators suggest that Daniel's position within the empire was like the prime minister. And so he was away on state business. And that was at the time that Nebuchadnezzar got inspired to erect this 10-story idol and demand that everyone worship it under pain of death. And you can imagine the conversations that followed, that likely followed, the miracle of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being delivered from certain death. And the words of Nebuchadnezzar's decree, or letter, which is to be read all around the world, it sounds more like an evangelist speaking. Something that an evangelist would write, not a pagan king. I mean, he says, and his dominion is from generation to generation. How mighty are his wonders? That doesn't sound like a guy who is an idol worshiper. Yet, that is what King Nebuchadnezzar wrote. He said, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. Well, all of us have wonders that the Lord has done for us. Now, our salvation is the greatest of wonders. We share that commonness. But there are other things that are unique to us as individuals. And that is our testimony. When people say, well, what's your testimony? Your testimony is, aside from the fact that you have been saved from hell and that you will live forever in eternity with the Lord, your testimony is what he has done for you. And like Nebuchadnezzar says from the lips of a pagan, he says, and it is good for us to declare it. And it is good for us to declare it, because that's the one thing. People can dispute the existence of God. They can be agnostics or atheists, or they can be whatever they call themselves, whatever they want to believe in. They can be an idol worshiper. They may worship many gods, different false gods. But the one thing that they can't dispute, or they can't deny, or they can't defend against, is your own personal testimony, because you were there. You saw it happen. And I mentioned before about praying for people and the seeming likelihood that it's in vain. And I can think of some, right offhand myself, that it does seem improbable, if not impossible, that it would yield results. That some of the people that I know personally, I think, there is no way. There is no way that guy could get saved. Yet, I know we're told in Isaiah chapter 55, which is often referred to as the Messiah's invitation to the world. Chapter 55, verses 8 and 9, he says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." And again in verses 10 and 11, "For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth, and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it." And I'm reminded in studying through Daniel that the impossible, not just the improbable, can happen, because it did. And although the text does not say it, I wonder how much prayer do you think went up from Daniel and his friends for Nebuchadnezzar? We know in reading through the entire text from actually chapters 1 through 4, that Daniel was elevated to a position of authority within the kingdom. And I'm sure, I don't think that we're reading into the text something that's not true when we say that Daniel was likely very close to Nebuchadnezzar. They were probably good friends. And he trusted Daniel. Obviously, he made him like a prime minister. He made him like the second guy in charge, the second highest guy in the entire kingdom. So they were friends. And I think that as such, I'm sure that Daniel had been praying for Nebuchadnezzar all along. Verses 4 through 9. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation. But at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belshazzar, according to the name of my God, little g, and in him is the spirit of the holy God, big G, capital G. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you, and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. The first thing that strikes you in this is that he says, therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me. I mean, you would think that after the first bout with a dream that he couldn't understand, that he wouldn't call those guys anymore. But he does. Why does he do that? Because he's foolish. And he's an idolater. And he doesn't know or have the knowledge of the living God. Even though he's surrounded by these guys. He's surrounded by Daniel and Daniel's friends. And so the most powerful guy in the world ever, and he's worried. He had this dream, and suddenly he says he was flourishing in his house. I mean, everything was going great. And he goes from that to worried and troubled. Basically, the text says that the king was stressed. He was stressed out. He was scared. And he's the head of the most powerful kingdom on the face of the earth. I mean, he can't be afraid of a foreign invading army. He wasn't sick. There was really no reason for him to be afraid, except for that he was afraid. And when he says, I saw a dream which made me afraid, the word used here for afraid is a feeling of dread or fear. And I think that all of us, to an extent, can identify with that, in the sense that as born-again believers, when we go to bed at night and we lay our head on that pillow, we might be worried about things, and we might sometimes, if it's something that is grave enough, we might worry through the night over it and toss and turn, and it chases sleep from us. But it shouldn't, because that's our flesh getting in the way. We really shouldn't. We're not supposed to do that. But I know that we do. But the one thing we don't have a fear of is the very things that I think that Nebuchadnezzar did have a fear of. He had a dread of, and that is that when you're around people in the daytime, you're at work or you're just around people generally, I think we tend to put on a different face. But at night, when you're laying there in bed in those nighttime hours, that's a different world. And I think that things do come to you, and you begin to think, and you think about your own mortality, and you think about, wow, what if I die? And if you live today, in this time in which we live, I'm sure there are people who will go to bed tonight, and they'll say, wow, man, this stuff with this ISIS group and these terrorists, what's going to happen? I mean, they're cutting people's heads off, and what if they come here? And what about Ebola? Now we have Ebola, and now we have some type of virus that's affecting children all across the nation, and it's causing a type of polio and paralysis, and that's even spread to adults now, they say. So a lot of people go to bed at night and they think about those things, and they have those fears, they have that dread, and I think that Nebuchadnezzar had that fear of what's in the future, what's in eternity, what's beyond the grave. We don't have that because we're born again believers and we don't have that spirit of fear. We can cry out, Abba, Father. And that's the difference between us and the world. Things can come and affect us, bad things can happen to us, but regardless, we're going to heaven. We're going to be with Jesus. So I think that was the problem with Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, he was afraid of what was next. So, king in command of the world's most powerful empire, and suddenly he's afraid. And he does the same thing he did before after the first dream. He calls for the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. But he says, they did not make known to me its interpretation. And this is kind of an interesting point right here too, because in this particular case, he didn't ask them to tell him the dream, what the dream was about, like the first time, because he didn't want them to trick him. He just said, can you interpret my dream? And the text leads us to believe that he told them what the dream was, what he saw. Many of the commentators think that if you look at the dream, and we're going to read through it here in a few minutes, it's pretty obvious. I mean, you can take a kind of a wild guess and you can see what the dream is about. You don't have to be able to be an interpreter of dreams, that the dream is really about Nebuchadnezzar. But some of the commentators say that they think that even though some of these quote-unquote wise men probably could have taken a shot at it and said, okay, king, this is what I think it says, then none of them did. Because they'd seen him throw people into the fire. They'd seen people rent in two in the kingdom when the king gets mad. And so they probably just kept quiet and said, we don't know what it means. Because he's still an idolater. And he resorts to what he knows has failed him in the past. And instead of calling upon what he knows, and he has proclaimed previously now, what cannot fail. His reliance was on nothing of worth or value. His reliance was on idols. In chapter 44 of Isaiah, verses 15 through 20, it says, and this whole chapter is speaking, the Lord is speaking about idols and idol worship and how foolish man can be. But we'll just pick up in verse 15 through 20. And he says, then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself, yet he kindles it and bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. He burns half of it in the fire. With this half, he eats meat. He roasts a roast and is satisfied. He even warms himself and says, ah, I am warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into a god, his carved image. He falls down before it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it. And I shall make the rest of it an abomination. Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside. And he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? In addition, let me see if I can find it here real quick. Similarly, in Habakkuk or Habakkuk, whichever suits your fancy, in chapter 2, verse 18 through 20, we read, what profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and in it there is no breath at all, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. So what total folly, what foolishness it is that a man would worship an idol. And yet, when you think about it, in today's world, in 2014, we have people who worship idols. I mean, people worship their bank accounts, they worship their stock portfolios. I mean, every day you hear, buy gold, buy silver, get ready for the coming crash. I mean, and I know the Bible tells us, it says that the prudent man sees trouble coming and he makes provision. So I'm not knocking being or making some kind of provision for what may come and what may occur, and likely will, it seems like, as each day goes by. But at the same time, that's not something that we want to worship, because when these things happen, the fancy car or whatever you have, the fancy house, whatever it is that somebody worships, whatever their idol is, it's not going to save them. Only the Lord saves. Verses 10 through 17. This is where Nebuchadnezzar at last calls for Daniel, and he asks for the interpretation of the dream. And this is after acknowledging that Daniel serves the true and the living God. Verse 10 through 17. These were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head, while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beast get out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beast on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So in a nutshell, the tree he saw in his dream is himself. He has become great and powerful, but he is filled with pride. It has been said that pride is the foundational sin of all the lost, and Nebuchadnezzar is filled with it. Consider he has witnessed the interpretation of the first dream, and in response, he builds an idol. Really, it's an idol of, or it's an idol to himself, celebrating his own greatness. Then in response to the Hebrew men refusing to bow down and worship, he has them tossed into the furnace, only to see them delivered by the hand of God, and he personally witnesses, he sees Jesus walking in the fire. And as much as he recognizes who that is and what is happening, he still refuses to humble himself. The tree in the dream is noted for its size, its strength, its beauty, the fruit it produced, the shelter it provides. It says that all the beasts of the earth could gather beneath it, the magnificence of the empire. And in his dream, Nebuchadnezzar sees a watcher. Now, I don't know who the watchers are. Let me just say that up front. Presumably, it's an angel, and it's some type of an angelic ministry that these angels were assigned to. I looked at a number of different commentaries And I did the word search on it, and it's not definitive, but I cannot see that it would be anything other than an angel. And they have some minister or a ministry that God has given them to do. They're referred to as the holy ones in the original translation. And this watcher comes down and he cries aloud saying, chop down the tree. And he says, but leave its stump. The watcher says the tree will lose its prominence and strength and beauty. Nevertheless, he says, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. Now the general consensus is that I don't know why the iron and the bronze. I know maybe somebody here knows, but I could not find specifically anything that was definitive as to why iron and bronze. Why the two? But the general consensus is that the band of iron and the bronze is for the stump's confinement or its protection, or both its confinement and its protection, because it's going to be essentially restored. The latter part of verse 15 and 16 says, and let him graze with the beast on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. Why? Well, the text gives us the answer. In order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. With regard to the, and let seven times pass over him, there's differing views on this, on the span of time. Nothing really conclusive, but I tend to think that it's a period of 7 years. Some say that it's a period of seasons. Seasons of sort, like it's winter, summer, fall, etc., for a total of 7 seasons. But it's interesting, David Guzik of Calvary Chapel Santa Barbara notes that there are no historical records of King Nebuchadnezzar's governmental activity between 582 BC and 575 BC, a period of 7 years. And they said that's highly unlikely that a king at that time, that there wouldn't be something that would have transpired, that would have been recorded about this king, something that he did in that 7 year period, and there's nothing. He says that the silence is deafening. He says, especially when you keep in mind how Near Eastern leaders like to egotistically trumpet their achievements and hide their embarrassments. Well, in defense of these guys that these Near Eastern leaders, I don't think it's any different today in 2014 when it comes to trumpeting their achievements and hiding their embarrassments. I think that we're still afflicted with that even in our day. Verse 18. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belshazzar, which is Daniel, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. So that's incredible to me that he recognizes that, and yet he would still call these guys to come in, these astrologers, these hocus-pocus guys, and have them take a stab at it. I mean, he sees the truth, but he just doesn't want to take that step. And like I said before, some of the commentators, they suggest that this dream really isn't so hard to unravel, and that some of his wise men might have taken a shot at it, but they were afraid to suggest what it meant. Verse 19 through 26. Then Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. He was astonished because he recognized who the tree was. The tree was actually the king. So the king spoke and said, Belshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. Verse 20, the tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely, and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beast of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the heavens had their home, it is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. For your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And as much as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you, after you come to know that heaven rules. Well, here to me, it's obvious that Daniel cared for Nebuchadnezzar, because he was astonished for a time when he heard the dream and he realized what lay ahead for Nebuchadnezzar because of his pride. But Daniel didn't deviate from the truth. He was very candid in his talk with Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 27, he says, therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. Basically, he was saying, maybe there's a way out. You have to change, though. You have to humble yourself before the living God. Maybe it's not too late. But it was too late, and time had run out, and Nebuchadnezzar had not humbled himself. And in verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. And we see it. We see the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy in verses 29 through 33. And at the end of the 12 months, so the Lord waited. The Lord was patient. He was long-suffering with Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't allow it to happen immediately. And at the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. There's a number of people, Christian believers, who think that this madness that came over Nebuchadnezzar is a mental illness that exists in the world today. And there's a couple of people that cite the actual medical terms for this particular illness, and there's at least two of them. Two different illnesses, they say, that are the same thing that happened to Nebuchadnezzar. But, and this I qualify as my own personal opinion, I don't think so. I don't think that it is something that existed or that exists today, and that a psychiatrist or a psychologist can look at them and diagnose them and say, well, that's exactly what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. I think what happened to Nebuchadnezzar is exactly what it says in verses 29 through 33. I think that we interpret the Bible literally, and I think that he ate grass like an oxen, that his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. Next, the first sign of Nebuchadnezzar's conversion was when he finally after those seven seasons when he finally looked up to heaven. Psalm 121 says, I will lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence comes my help? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. And in verse 34 of chapter 4, it says, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's attitude was not just one of humility, but it had gone from humility to an attitude of worship. Verse 35. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. This is Nebuchadnezzar speaking now. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, verse 37, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. Just a couple of parting notes. I think that it's clear that in James, he says, God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Nebuchadnezzar learned that the hard way. And if there's an abiding lesson here, it's plain that God does resist the proud, and he gives grace to the humble. Another thing is that there's a prophetic significance in this account in Babylon. And it's used in the scriptures as a figure of the world system at large. Nebuchadnezzar's madness, they say, foreshadows the madness of Gentile nations in their rejection of God. And I think we see that today. I think that's very prominent today. And Nebuchadnezzar's fall typifies Jesus' judgment of the nations. And his restoration foreshadows the restoring of some of these nations in the millennial kingdom.